Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we're going to have a great conversation. What are you hearing? What are you listening to? What are you putting out there? What are they actually hearing and listening to? We're talking about relationships, communication. What's really going on out there? We as humans really are stuck on this notion that what we put out, everyone has to hear and it has to be gospel and they must follow, you know, or them must feel the way I expect them to or the way I want them to, or I'm going to command them with my words. Goodness gracious, how did we get all of this wrong these past few decades? Or is it maybe just we've gotten it wrong all eons? People have shut down. They don't hear. They don't listen. They look for eye candy. They take things at face value. Some people just turn around and spew, and it's not even about what's really bothering them. Today, my guest is Ellen Gendelman, and her book is When Ice Cream Is Not Enough, Stories That Nurture Loving Relationships. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jeanette, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. Don't you think, Ellen, you know, these communications, I think when we got dropped down in this human body, boy, we really messed it up, huh?
Some of the time we messed it up, but forgive me for having rose-colored glasses. When we get it right, those are some of the most beautiful, intimate moments, that, and we cherish them in our lives.
You know, I think we're always in the quest of that, but we get so stuck in other stuff. Like, I mean, even with social media now, you can write down a sentence on social media and you will get 100 responses. Like, I wrote something one day. I said, man, I really wonder about these headaches. I've had them forever. I was kind of like putting an esoteric kind of concept out there. And I got like all of these comments on there. Oh, did you try something for your sinuses? Oh, yeah, maybe it's the flu. Oh, my gosh, did you do this? And it's always like, but I didn't ask you to fix me. I was just sharing something, you know? Right?
Typical on that one. Somehow people hear a question, many people hear a question, and they think that means they have a responsibility to know the answer to the question, or in some way they're lacking. So there's an internal pressure. Oh, question means I must know answer. Question means listen. And if we pause and listen to the other person, not just the content of what they're sharing, then we respond from a very different place.
Yeah, you know, with this show, I've always really prided myself that I wanted to ask questions. It was going to be put things out there. And it wasn't about always providing the answers, the solutions, or templates. It was more about allowing something in your head to say, you know, get out of the dust kind of idea. It's almost like I'm going to dust the house, but you kind of have to, you know, where is it going to settle next? You know, I think that's probably the most effectual kind, because you can get to the root then of what really is bothering someone or what someone really does want to communicate. You know, we see these conversations where people spew. I don't know if I'm sure you're well familiar with that. People talk and they almost want to spit at you, and you're going, this is not what you're trying to say. So should I let you keep going until you get to it, or should I just have a seat, right?
Exactly. Actually, it's interesting you say that, because as a therapist, I usually have a goal in my head, and the goal in my head is collaborated with my client, and there's a treatment plan. However, sometimes what a client wants, and sometimes what they even need emotionally, is that listening ear and just to get out their pain, get out their frustration in a safe place and in a non-judgmental place. when therapy becomes all about venting, and now I feel better, but the same patterns continue that create the upset in the first place, I need to wonder if I'm really servicing that person, and I choose in most cases to put it out there.
Right.
And to put that pattern.
I think we see that too, even when, you know, when people are saying, oh yeah, I went to meditation class. Oh yeah, I went to yoga. I got into the spiritual realm. I thought about it. Then 2 seconds later, if you catch them in the parking lot, they're cursing on their cell phone, they're eating their lunch, and they're getting halfway changed on the way out the door, you know? So exactly what do they learn, you know? Or, I mean, in other words, you can't be in this spot of knowing and jump into not knowing for the rest of your life just because it's a fad, right?
Interesting. I think what you're talking about is it's great to have that moment, that light bulb moment or that aha. But if we want to sustain the change, then we want the transformation and we want to follow through when we get the aha. So now that I know that, what does that mean? What
right.
does that mean in my relationships? What does that mean in my life? What am I going to do differently right now with that aha? And that allows us to get to the next step.
Don't you find sometimes when people are talking, they'll come to that and they'll say, oh, then maybe I did something, quote, wrong. And that idea or moment of saying you did something wrong really puts a label on you, and then you're coming from a point of either victimhood or a point of judgment and base things, and then you want to right the wrong. Instead of just saying it might be an experience and, oh, okay, that's not an experience I wish to continue, and I will, you know, work to improve. Two different, totally different sets of answers, yet so many think that they are the same, don't you think?
That is very interesting what you're saying. How would I comment to that? I think what I would say, Dr. Jeanette, is it's okay if we can tolerate that we were wrong without thinking about it in a shame-based way.
Right.
The fact that we make mistakes just means we're human and we all make mistakes. And taking responsibility that, oh, now that I hear that perspective, maybe I did do something wrong and I can take responsibility and do better next time. But if self-compassion accompanies us with that recognition, then I think we're doing it in a healthy way. And we don't necessarily have to avoid the I was wrong, which is a normal, healthy part of acknowledgement. It's only when it becomes, and therefore I'm hopeless, or I'm bad, or I'm inadequate, or I'm ashamed
right.
of myself, that's when I think it takes us down a really unhealthy road. Does that make sense to you?
Sure, it does. Because, you know, I have some acquaintances, and they were, oh, I'm going to go to this retreat so I can, quote, better myself. And all of these things come out from them, and then they come back and they try to superimpose it upon the people that weren't at the retreat. But yet they don't take any of their friends with them to the retreat because they don't want anyone to hear their dirty laundry, you know? So, I mean, in effect, that's actually what a lot of the defeatist mechanisms of life are, is how far can I run from the untruth or that which I'm hiding until it catches up with me and, oh, gosh, how am I going to bite the dust then, you know? Don't you think? And, I mean, sometimes just as, you know, if you do have a wrongful moment, you say, you know, I'm really sorry. I understand it. I'm hearing it back, and I will change my ways, period. It's not about blah, 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 you know? And if you do get the blah, 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 that's trying to tell you that there's another step deeper that you have to go to, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And taking responsibility, I think we start with self-acceptance and self-compassion, because that way we can take responsibility in a constructive way. And eventually we take ourselves with us, so we can't really run away from ourselves. I'm working right now with one of my clients is a young teenager going through a pretty significant depression, and she's been scared and teary. And the other day we were talking, and she said to me, I just want to run away. I just want to get away.
Right.
And I said to her, I hear that. I hear that you just want to get away because it's so painful where you are. What's going to be different when you go to a different place, though? Because you're coming with you.
Right. You know, I had said to someone that one time, it was a family member, and they said similar idea. And I said, okay, so do me a favor. Find a counselor and yourself. Go sit in a room. No chairs, no nothing, no interference. And sit down and call in that fear. And ask that fear to come in. And whatever that fear is, I want you to dance with it. Talk to it. See how big it is. Let it overwhelm you and see just who is boss. And then you eventually figure out that the fear is, quote, unreal and unrecognized. And then you're able to say, okay, let me try that again. And, you know, you keep trying these things. And what that does is that builds up your sense of fear of something that isn't perpetually there, that isn't really out there. It's just something that you fear could be a potential, you know?
I love that. I love that analogy. I often work with my clients who have fears and anxieties, as we all do, with an analogy of who's in the driver's seat. Is it going to be you or your fear?
Yeah.
And how is it different when you put yourself in the driver's seat? How is it different when your fear is driving you? What does it look like? What does it feel like? And to tune in like that. And it's when you see the triumph that a person can experience when they take ownership instead of running away, but they look that fear in the eye, and then they're able to live with it, but not to be paralyzed by it. It's huge.
You know, because if you call in fear, and then you ask them to describe it, it's like, what does it look like? Does it have a drag on? Is it a woman? Is it a man? Is it a thing? Put it over here. Here's a table. Sit it down. Put it right here. They can see that it is separate from the fear. Do you know what I mean? In other words, the reality and the fear are two different, totally different things, and they can start to work towards that. You know, I think sometimes we see that a lot, too, with people with pain these days. They will consistently go to other physicians. They'll say, I'm in terrible pain. And they'll say, what hurts? And they'll say, oh, my knee. Let's use an example. My knee hurts, you know. And they'll say, okay, well, let's do all the tests, run all the tests, see everything. Oh, well, I can't find it. Where is it? And they'll say, but my knee hurts. And then they start doing the pain medicine. And your knee still hurts. It's like, where or what is hurting? And it's, you don't even ask all the other questions of when does it hurt, where did it hurt, why did it start hurting, or how about it's not your knee, how about it might be your upper left shoulder that's out of balance because now you're pushing more weight on your knee.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that which the differentiation, you know, of being able to go through these symptoms and be able to think out of the space that you're in can kind of reflect back into the space to say, maybe that isn't a thing in the first place. So maybe the fear wasn't a thing in the first place, and you're looking at it another way, and you're saying, oh, because I had that happen to me before, or I saw it happen to someone before, or someone told me that it was going to happen, and it wasn't in my wheelhouse, I didn't understand it. You know, same thing with pain, you know, is like, it hurts, just take it away. Same idea.
Exactly. Exactly, and I think that's also part of living in our society today, that in the quest for instant results, instant pain removal, we, instead of developing greater tolerance so that we can produce the pearls from the discomfort, which is really one of the main ways we do produce our pearls of resilience and of learning, by throwing the pain away very quickly, we miss out on a deeper understanding, a deeper awareness, and tremendous learning and growth opportunities.
Almost too, though, when we look at pain these days, or people have a complex disorder or a chronic illness, or, you know, they're coming and they're seeing therapists and everything for quite a while, I really look at it as we're truly trying to focus in on one thing to be able to pigeonhole it and extract it or alleviate it. When really, chronic pain comes at you from all ways. When you say you have chronic pain, people don't want to be around you, so they're annoyed. So that rises that issue. Chronic pain, you might have to leave for work longer, earlier, and you might have to work longer, and man, it just gets worse by noon, and you just don't you're not an effective worker. You might come home and it's like you just don't feel like eating, so you're not nourishing yourself. Chronic pain could also be, too, is that you just don't feel like being in a loving relationship. Or chronic pain could be you start answering people snippy because you just hurt so much, you just don't, it just comes out of your mouth. I think same thing with relationships sometimes. We say they're always supposed to be hunky-dory, ding-dong, perfect. You know, everybody's looking for that. But, you know, there's a lot of things coming at people these days. Work, kids, job, money, social media, a stature and a place to be in, a way to actually survive. We see everything on television. There's so many more influences in our circle. There's more, like, I call them pins sticking at us, that once you get all these pins sticking at you, sort of like, you know, there's, it's hard to decipher as therapists and physicians. It's hard for us to decide to decipher all of that mesh and see how we can get it to back off and resonate to quiet down, don't you think?
Very much so. Very much so. Our lives are complex. And I think the tricky part is that often people don't even realize on a conscious level what they're doing, what they're choosing, and completely why they're choosing it, which is why sometimes an objective listener who can watch them and hear what they're not saying or what they're saying in many ways and reflect that back and help them get to a place of heightened awareness so that the subconscious process can become conscious. And then they can really have the power of choice and to determine, is this working for me? It might be solving one problem, but it might be making 10 other problems much worse. And is that a price I'm willing to keep paying?
And also, too, you know what, Ellen, I think that a lot of people want the quick fix, and then they think that then they'll go back to their regular habits. I think sometimes if you can just work with one pin that's sticking at you and it takes you 6 months and then you're on to the next one, great. But I think that also there are no failures in life. If you're working at the same pin that's sticking at you for 30 years, so be it. You know, I think we want to cast out those who seem to take a little longer to walk along their path. And we cast out those who don't walk, talk, and quack like a duck, right? Don't you think?
So. Very much so. And I think that perspective actually informs my teaching and principling for many years before I made this career transition and went back to school for therapy years ago. But I just felt so strongly that so many students in a classroom are forced to be in one box and one type. And any child that doesn't fit in that box, well, we better medicate them because the teacher can't control them in the same way, or they can't sit down the whole entire day, or they have to doodle while instead of just taking notes. And the tolerance for different ways, different styles, different needs, different time spans is diminished if everybody has to fit in the same box. And to add to that, I think that our world and our society is enriched when we can all interact and gain and learn from people who have different styles, different paces, different levels of awareness, because through those differences we learn. And it's enriching. And when we all have one group think, it's so sad because how are we gaining? We're saying, yes, sir, yes, dear, yes, dear. Where's the learning?
Yeah. You know, so many people have asked me, you know, well, how do you help? And I'm like, I help each individual wherever they are. And they're like, what? What is that talking about? And what and the idea is that I don't have a template that I do anything with, and sure, I'm listening you as well, because if you say that you have the solution, the answer to, quote, fix something, that's just like looking at the symptoms or the thing that's rearing its head. Has nothing to do with anything else concerning about it. You know, when you think back on what you just said about kids in this classroom, you know, I can remember when I grew up on my childhood, you know, sometimes in the mornings, life was not so great, you know, getting up and going to school and how I got there or whatever was occurring in the house. And I would always go to school and kind of sit there. And I can remember I would always get then beat up at school too. You know, the teacher would, I mean, I was left-handed, and in the 50s you weren't supposed to be left-handed. So the nuns, they would hit your left hand with a ruler and make you use your right one. But anyway, you know, we would think that, you know, I look back at those and I think, you know, all of those times you're getting hit up here, you're getting hit up there, you're getting hit up there. And we look at kids in classrooms these days, they have a lot harder problems too. And you're asking them to sit in the classroom and listen to you and spit it back out. How unfortunate is that?
And it's,
you know,
not learning. It is not learning, in my
right.
opinion.
And I think that's why don't you think that's why we're all going to now, so many people are doing homeschooling or, quote, living off the grid, because what they're doing is they're taking their people and honoring them as individuals, and look how they flourish. So much different, right?
Absolutely. And I still have hopes that some schools are going to get it, because I do think that the social opportunities in school and the allowance when a school understands for differentiation and helping students develop in many different areas can be huge, because they learn to function within a community. But if they're in a school system that cuts off the feet that are too long, and has, you know, the chair and the desk that are the one size fits all, then there are many, many people for whom that doesn't work. Even the studies on self-esteem that are so sadly true, where you can have a child who feels so good about themselves, and then they go to first grade, and what happens?
That's the end of them.
Right? That's it. That's it. And I was actually principal of both elementary and high school, and I saw a lot of that. And actually, that's one of the reasons I chose to help people. I say to people, I just moved my classroom, because I truly believe that therapy work and coaching work is learning. It's learning in a real internal sense without having to make recess schedules and teachers meetings and edit report cards and all of that, which is not my passion. It was the working with people. So now I get to work with people.
You know, it's really about honoring the human, and I really think that in 2018, I've always spoken about this, and I said that this year we had better get it. We had better get that there is no I, there is we, and that we have to respect a human being, which is ourselves and others. It's just, I think if we don't get it by the end of the year, I'm not sure where humanity is going to go. And then, I have another show also that I'm a co-host, and we speak a lot about addictions, opioids, heroin, and all this, and, you know, effects on people in grief and all this, and suicide. And there is this school in Las Vegas, and you know in high schools when they have problem kids, you get excommunicated, you get expelled, you get sent out. In other words, you're out of the norm. And then that's when the kids get in worse trouble. Well, this school takes all of the X's, and that's all that's in the school. And what they do is they just give them what they need. They need love, care, support, food, honoring, support, keeping away from the troublemakers and all that other, reducing all of the stressors by being who they are and allowing them to grow who they are, instead of growing into something else to create something, you know, that they're trying to avoid. And I think they're having some successes too. And I think that is the idea of how can we start to respect people instead of always putting them away, put them in a jail, put them in nursing homes when they don't walk and talk or take care of themselves, or putting them into rehab facilities or these mental hospitals. It's just getting kind of... I guess it's getting to be more prominent, but really if you look back on history, gosh, I mean, when you had tuberculosis, you were sent to a sanitarium, you know, like, you know, and left there. So, or put into a city or a town, and you were left there. When they couldn't understand what was wrong with you or how to, quote, control you, that's where you went. So really we haven't far changed our outlook, you know, after all of these even centuries, do you think?
Yeah, you know what occurred to me as you were speaking, Dr. Jeanette? 2 points. Number one is that it's wonderful for schools who are realizing that and they're finally doing that, but that's after there's been a lot of damage. And
right.
I work with parents a lot. If we can have a proactive approach going on in our homes and in our schools so that we don't only have to repair after somebody is broken and hope that we'll
right.
be able to take away some of those scars, that would be my dream, one person at a time, one family at a time. And also, number two, you reminded me of a research study that I saw. It happened in Portugal, and Portugal tried to work with their addicts in a very different way. And instead of punishing them or, putting them in jail, fining them, they gave them opportunities for connection. And
right.
their addiction levels went down dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching a TED Talk on this, actually, where the person said very powerfully that really addiction is a disease of isolation.
Right.
And so the opposite of addiction could really be connection. And
right.
I think, in a way, a lot of what you and I have been discussing so far today has to do with isolation into a person's pain, either feeling broken or feeling unloved or suffering and just wanting a quick fix, as opposed to connecting to our core and then being able to connect to others from an authentic place.
You know, I also see that as it's also replicated in the elderly. Elderly are the biggest pharmaceutical takers. They're the biggest ones on pain pills, and they're the biggest ones on having all of these medical interventions because they feel broken, they feel less than, they feel put out to pasture, and they just sit there and say, okay, just have at it, just deteriorate, tick off the clock, give me a calendar, I'll check off the day every time, And I think also, too, we've really done a huge disservice to our elderly. And by elderly, I don't mean 80s and 90s. I mean anybody over the age 50 these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we see that, I think, when we look at it, it's really about the decrease in relationships for elders. How do elders even communicate with anyone they don't anymore? We see this, randomly on TV or something, you'll see how many times has an elderly person had a conversation with anyone? There's some that will say a couple of years. The only one I talk to is my UPS man or the mailman.
Exactly.
They don't have any relationships or conversations. So how can we say that, so they're pretty much human beings that are put out to pasture too.
Right. And, you remind me as you're speaking why relationships are my passion and where that came from. May I share?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my father died when I was a little girl, and my mother raised us, myself and my little sister. And she told us many times that even if she knew she only would have had 9 years with my father, she would willingly marry him again for the love that they shared, as well as for the two little girls that were produced through their love. And so I think it was planted in me just the power of a loving connection and that could even transcend life itself
mm-hmm.
and have a generational effect. And when somebody doesn't have that, even if they're living, they don't have a life in that sense.
Right.
So that, I just think of, I can't think of anything more meaningful than spending a big part of my life making sure that my own personal relationships as a wife, as a mother, a grandmother, a mother-in-law, and sister, you name it, but also helping people to achieve those kind of secure relationships, it's a joy, it's an unparalleled joy when you see people get closer together.
Right, and you shared that in your book. Your book, again, is When Ice Cream is Not Enough, Stories That Nurture Loving Relationships. And it's about looking at a relationship from both sides. And, sometimes we will say, you will continuously repeat a conversation you have with someone, and you walk around to get everyone's opinion on that conversation. But little do you ask the other person, what did you hear? And if you ever ask them what they heard, you would be shocked at 99% of your conversations if you're ineffective in being able to get their point across or be able to connect with that person, that they it's not the same thing, right?
Absolutely not. And that's why I say it really starts with self-compassion, because if we're defensive or if we feel inadequate, then this need to prove, this need to explain our points again and again, this need to make sure that people agree with us, because if they don't agree with us, what does that say about us? So that has to, the healthier we are as individuals, the healthier we are in our relationships. And then from that healthy point, it's so much easier to be able to be accepting to the emotions that are under the content of what somebody is experiencing. When, to give a stereotypical example, when a woman turns to her husband, perhaps, and says, you know, you're never home, and you're always out, and even when you're home, you're on your phone, and I don't appreciate it, and the typical reaction might be to get defensive, like, what are you yelling at me? I'm on the phone. Look at yourself when the kids want you. You know, you're watching YouTube and Netflix and everything else. You think you're present, and then we have a nice escalated argument. And yet if we would look underneath, that woman is saying, honey, I miss you, and I'm lonely, and I'm kind of scared, and I'm wondering, am I important to you? And if he heard that, because he was feeling in a place of good health, good emotional health, and then he could turn to her and reassure her and say, you know what, you are important to me, and I have been out too much, and I want to make more time for you because there's nothing more important. What a different kind of conversation and experience could come up.
Yeah, and to get to that point sometimes, people have to go to rehab after rehab after rehab, and they still don't get it. Because rehab is still all about the one person, the one that's spewing. It's not about the connection or the communication with another. You know, I think that sometimes, a lot of times when people go into rehabs, they go into jails, they go into retreats, like I said in the beginning of this conversation, they're really just going for one thing, you know, to fix whatever's wrong with them, and then they'll be able to be dropped back into society. But a relationship is really the relationship with the mailman, the relationship with your next-door neighbor, the relationship with the person that you're on the other side of the phone with. A relationship with someone that you may just purchase something at the store or something. These are all relationships. We're not just talking about the ones in your own four walls of your house, you know? And I think sometimes when we have a glitch or hit the wall, we want to say, fix it, fix it, fix it, and everything else will come out good, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And as you said, the relationship with the other person on the phone, I wondered how we're doing, Dr. Jeanette.
Right. Yeah. And doesn't that make a big difference, don't you think? Because when people are talking, it's like, can you listen? Can you hear me? And sometimes, you know, I have a conversation sometimes with my kids. They'll say to me, oh, I haven't heard from you in a long time. I'll say, yeah, I know. Why don't you give me a call? So then I would call them or something, and they'll say, well, you know, Ma, I never call you because you really don't have much to say other than, you know, what's the weather like and how are you doing, and that's it. I said, well, isn't that fabulous? Because I don't have any drama to drag in to be able to spew with you. I mean, pretty much basically that is the greatest conversation. Sometimes less is better because it just, there was nothing that I needed, you know, and there was nothing that I had to fix and there was nothing I had to validate, you know, and it was just about being present in the moment, don't you think?
Very lovely. I mean, it's true, and it's a sad point what you're making, really, that sometimes if long conversations are only about neediness or what's wrong in life or a whining session, then that's sad and that gets old pretty quickly.
Right.
Where if it's sharing happy moments and it's sharing surprising moments and it's you know, delighting in the good and finding out how someone else's life is, then those conversations are very nurturing and exciting and something that both people can actually anticipate.
Right. It does make a difference, you know, when you have conversations to be able to see how people will engage with each other, you know. it's sometimes, you know, you say, oh, are we so lost in the conversations? Can you share a little bit about your technique in your book? Because I think it's very unique in the way you wrote it.
Sure. Okay. How can I share with you? Well, first of all, they're written in story form. So it's not about dry clinical text, even though I happen to eat up clinical text because I love it. I am a voracious reader myself. But this is written in everyday language. And when people ask me who my audience is, I have to admit to you I get stuck, because to me, my audience is anybody who's in a relationship. So the better question would be who my audience is not. And basically, there's stories of conflict that happen among family members, among friends, among acquaintances, where the story of the conflict is told by the way each person in the conflict experienced it, their feelings, their thoughts, and their behaviors. And then, once you hear both sides, you have a totally, totally different picture. I've had many people say to me, were you looking in our window? Because the stories are based on real life scenarios that we all experience. And I've had many people say, we were surprised. I read one side and I thought, yeah, what was that other person thinking? This is so obvious. And then I read the other side and I thought, oh, there's really a valid point there, too. And that is really the technique in the book, because once we have the ability to shift perspective, to realize that it's not about content, but it's about the emotions underneath the content, and there is validity there, we have the ability to turn towards each other and to understand each other and to work together. So that is the nature of most of the stories in the book. And then at the end of the book, there's an ICARE section, which is an acronym for Internal Compassion and Relationship Enhancement. And what we do is we use a few sample characters that you've gotten friendly with in the book, and we use that method, which is basically a method of using self as therapist, to work through some of the angst and some of the pain that one might be feeling, that these characters might have been feeling in the story, and help them get to a place of calm, a place of clarity, so then they're in a position to deal with the problem or whatever, to deal with the conflict in a way that was true to them, true to their values, and being true to their core. And I will tell you that in most stories, we do not write the ending purposely, because there's no one right way, which Dr. Jeanette, that goes back to what we were saying before, that right. There's not a one-size-fits-all. It's basically gaining understanding and awareness to help come closer in our relationships.
Yeah, because everybody is so different. It might sound the same, but it might feel totally different. You know, I think sometimes, I know having kids, you know, my kids are now much older, and I would say something to them like, oh my gosh, why are you out so late? You need to get home. You have to take care of this. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. Blah, 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 blah. And really, if I had stopped the conversation in my tracks and said to them, you know, I was really concerned. It was late and it was dangerous weather out. I was hoping you were safe. You didn't communicate back to me. And I would like to be able to know that you will be all right. And I'm kind of worried about that. Two totally different conversations, yet if you flip the coin, they could happen at any moment in anyone's home, yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, it all boils down to which place in ourselves are we communicating from? Right. Are we communicating from a reactive place, an ego-based place, a place of anger, a place of frustration? Is it about us when we're communicating? Mm-hmm. Or is it from a place of love, a place of concern, a place of thinking, what does this other person need to hear right now, and how can I best convey it? And that those are going to be some of the determinants, sounding like they're small, but making a huge, significant difference.
let's talk for a second about change, you know, after you do figure out what you're doing. And then just like I said in the beginning of this conversation about you go in to meditate, you come out and you're yelling at your phone. Well, sometimes, you know, when people go into therapy or they go into talk sessions or wherever, and they say, and you have the two people there who they would have wished to change the communication, there's still that old imprint of, but that's not how you always say it. You always say it this way. So in other words, history, imprints, and the past have to really be dredged. I almost say, you know, bring in that crane because we've got to get it all out on the table because then we have to let it go. All of that dredging up of all of that stuff, if you completely do not evacuate and excavate everything, you're probably not going to get where you need to be, right?
I would definitely agree with that, and a big part of my work actually is based on emotionally focused couples work, but in, even for individuals, emotionally focused work, which basically, when we look at the patterns, most of the time in relationships, and I'm not talking about something that's clearly abusive, when there is one wrongdoer and an innocent victim, and I'm certainly not going to play blame the victim. But let's talk about a relationship where both people are human. Sometimes each one can be wrong. Each one can make mistakes, and each one has repair to do. And in that type of situation, understanding that it's not about one person being evil and the other person, you know, being angelic, but it's about patterns that are influenced by our childhood, influenced by our temperament, influenced by the significant people in our lives. And when we fall into patterns when we're triggered and we have the capability to learn that cycle, to crystallize that cycle, to see when we're most vulnerable to those patterns in the cycle. And then here's the good news, we have the power to change that cycle. And I've had so many couples that say, oh, we caught ourselves, we're going right back into that dance, and we saw the dance, and we changed the dance, because we can only change the dance when we learn the dance. So That would be the next part, which can create a lasting change. And again, that goes, there's nothing more fulfilling than being privileged to watch that happen and watch that unfold in people's lives and be a part of their journey.
Well, Ellen, in closing, also to going back to the beginning of the conversation, was really about how are we going to change the world from here out? And I think sometimes we've now discussed all the conversations from children to middle age to elders. And I think that almost if we really want to change the world, let's everybody just click our red shoes and hope tomorrow that all that dust will be gone, because it is across generations. You know, you can work with, it's almost like you don't notice you got a problem until you hit the wall and which generation you're going to hit it in, you know. And when you hit it, then it affects all of the other generations around you if they are willing and ready to be able to make that change. So that's what we do here on this radio show today, is about affecting change, is about how can we see that perhaps if I'm a mother, oh my gosh, I don't have to speak like my mother did to my children, and we can learn better ways. And then that, in effect, would change three generations. Yes?
Yes. Yes. With exclamation points. That's what
right.
It's all about.
And then, you know, and when they're not willing to be able to do it, it's time, like, cut the cord, but continue to do it if you believe that you're in a space where it is going to work. You know, I think sometimes they're so afraid to say, oh, but your blood family, you have to. No, you don't. Don't you think? I think it's really about having ownership for the space you're in, no matter who it is. If you're in a job that doesn't work, it's like, okay, cut the cord. If you are in a relationship with someone, cut the cord. Don't you think?
If it's toxic and not good for your health, then it's, and it's not repairable, but it's damaging, then people need to be willing to look at that and see. It's the same thing with trauma or pain. If we keep falling down and hurting ourselves in the exact same place, then we're not going to be able to heal from that wound. So if there is a relationship that continues to create the trauma, and they're going once a week to therapy, and we have to just keep on healing the same reoccurring trauma, it's not going to be helpful or long-lasting.
And also, too, if you want to change the world, this is the steps you need to take. You know, it's not always about just us. I mean, the I. Think about it as the us, you know. So if you kind of let some people go, they'll kind of figure it out on their own eventually, you know. And sometimes letting go is exactly what might be necessary for many people. So, you know, it's just a totally different way of looking at things. And what we talked about today, Ellen, is all about conversations, how we speak to people, how we hear, how we resonate, how we communicate that exactly what is important, and leave all that other dogma somewhere else. You know, I think social media is giving us a really good, I don't know what you want to call it, but it's giving us a real good foothold on how to create drama, you know, and it's actually going the wrong way, you know. So many times I'll see on Facebook people will put quotes from leaders in the past or books they read in the past. And I'm like, I don't want to see, I even posted, I said, how different would Facebook be if we didn't post things from other people and actually put what we thought or put what we felt or put what we needed? Gosh, the whole thing would go kaput in a day, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's all about hanging your hat on an illusion instead of creating your own reality. Two totally different things, right?
And that's right. And that's sad, because if people are looking for illusions, it means there is a lack of happiness and fulfillment in their own lives.
Right.
I mean, I just feel so privileged to wake up every day and do what I love. And if anything, just lack enough hours to do more of it. And it's exhilarating. And even if I'm physically tired by the end of the day, I'm just emotionally so grateful.
Great. Well, Ellen, it was such a pleasure to have you with us. Can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about you?
I sure can. I would love to. For my email, awindowwithin@gmail.com. And I do have a website, Dr. Jeanette, and that website is awindowwithin.net. And I would very much love to be contacted by your listeners. I would be most grateful if they would have a look at the book and give me some feedback. It is available on Amazon, and that would be a wonderful opportunity.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure to have you with us.
And thank you for having me, Dr. Jeanette. It was an enlightening conversation from my side, too.
Oh, well, thank you so much. If you'd like to find out more information about Ellen, please check on the link on the bottom of today's show page, and you go directly to her website. And it is really very, very important to understand that there is so much out there that we are able to change in our world. And it really is about creating more relationships that are effective, that are able to say, you know what, I'm kind of tired of that old dogma. Man, did you ever have a conversation with them? They just seem to weigh you down. And we can always have a really choice in how we think about things, how we share with others, how we continue the dogma, and really think about your social media posts. What is it really all about? What are you doing on there? Spewing something else? So do make a conscious decision to be able to contribute to humanity, the good things and the change, versus being able to drag up all the old past. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family. Clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.